You can do pretty much anything for 5 minutes. I also challenge you to right now plant one micro-intention into your work tomorrow. Whether that trigger is to be more mindful of what you want to accomplish before attending a meeting, starting a task or a project, checking your smartphone, or opening up your email inbox, right now, think about a trigger that you will use tomorrow to step back from your work and reflect on how you're feeling, thinking, and what you intend to accomplish. It's not easy to train your attention muscle, but that's what makes the process worthwhile. It's an incredible thing when you train your brain to conquer itself. Part 7. Taking Productivity to the Next Level. Chapter 22. Refueling. Takeaway. The power of incremental improvements lies in the fact that although they're not significant by themselves, week after week, month after month, they add up to produce results in the long term that will blow you away. Small changes lead to big results, especially when food is involved. Suffering through Soylent. There was only one productivity experiment I conducted that I completely and utterly failed at. It wasn't my experiment to live in total isolation for 10 days, though that one was pretty rough, and I'll get to it in the next part. It was my experiment to eat only Soylent for a week. The idea behind Soylent is actually pretty cool. It is a powdered food substitute that contains everything your body nutritionally needs over the course of the day. You just mix the powder with water and then drink up the concoction a few times a day. It tastes like thick oat water, but not entirely in a bad way. Over the course of the day, you don't need to eat anything else. For the experiment, I elected to formulate my own recipe for the stuff, following a recipe that had been posted online that was very similar to one a company by the same name sold. The recipe contained ingredients like oat flour for carbohydrates, pea protein powder for protein, ground flax for fiber, brown sugar for flavor and carbs, crushed up multivitamins for vitamins and minerals, and even olive oil for fat, which I added whenever I mixed the powder with water. The great part about Soylent is that you can modify the recipe to meet your exact dietary needs. Need a bit more protein? Great, just up the ratio of protein to carbs in the recipe. Need some extra vitamin D to help you beat the winter blues? Just crush up a few more tablets and add them to the recipe. The idea behind Soylent is awesome. It saves you time, since you can prepare it in bulk, and it requires no additional prep time. It saves you attention, because you can continue focusing on work instead of stopping to prepare food. And it saves you money. During the experiment, I calculated that, even with the extra protein powder I added, it cost me a paltry $7.98 to live off the stuff every day. Without the extra protein powder, it would have cost me under $5 a day. For the love of food. But while the Soylent met all my nutritional needs, it didn't address my deep and abiding love of food. I can honestly say that I remember pretty much every meal I've eaten from nicer restaurants and even from takeout. So far, I haven't lifted any words from my blog in this audiobook, but I'm going to cheat a bit here. I think I encapsulated my love of food pretty well in the post I wrote up about my Soylent experiment. Quote, after my first year of university, I hopped on a plane to run around Europe on a solo trip. I don't remember much from that trip. Note from future Chris, could it have been all the smartphone usage? Even though it was just a few years ago, but I remember the food. I remember the tender rabbit I ate at a Michelin-starred restaurant in the central town square in Krakow, Poland. I remember walking down a side street of Paris, massive baguette in hand, breaking off and scarfing down chunks of the loaf as I walked by people I couldn't speak to or understand. I remember what I ate for breakfast today, oat flour pancakes and an apple, for lunch, rice and homemade chili, and for dinner, vegetables, pita, hummus, and even more chili and rice. I also remember what I ate yesterday and the day before that. Take, for example, something as simple as the texture of food. I love the feeling of biting into a fresh stick of celery, feeling the fiber-rich framework of the vegetable crumble like a stone castle under the weight of my teeth. To me, food is poetry, the very tapestry that my day threads in and out of and around. If I'm excited on a given day, more often than not, I'm excited about something I'm going to eat. End quote. By the second day of the Soylent experiment, I missed food. Badly. Well, the first day was a challenge to slog through. On the second day, when I woke up and realized that I wouldn't be able to make myself a fancy breakfast and instead had to drink the oat-flavored smoothie concoction all day long, I wanted to curl up and hibernate for a week. That afternoon, while busing home from a speaking event, I recall looking longingly out the window, thinking about all the meals I would eat once the experiment was finished. It was in that moment that I decided to end the experiment. I didn't care how much cooking or prep time Soylent would save me, how much more energy it would give me relative to when I didn't eat right 100% of the time, or even how much money I would save, despite how cash-strapped I was at the time. I was willing to do a lot to become more productive, but I chose not to follow through with this experiment. I valued saving myself a week of hell more than I did my productivity. On the bus ride back home, just as the sun was beginning to set, I got off the bus a stop early, walked to Burger King, and ordered the biggest Whopper they had, with jumbo-sized everything. There were no survivors. Energy and productivity. On the surface, it could seem like things that affect your energy, like what you eat, whether or not you exercise, and how much sleep you get, don't seem to have much of an impact on how much you accomplish. But as I learned from a few of my experiments, much like with single tasking or meditating, this isn't true at all. Energy is the fuel you burn throughout the day in order to be productive, and without it, your productivity is toast. Especially on a neurological level, having lasting energy is critical. Your brain cells consume double the energy that the other cells in your body consume. Even though your brain makes up just 2-3% of your body mass, it burns 20% of the calories you take in. As you invest in your productivity, having a strong mental function becomes crucial, as does having a lot of energy. This is especially important in the knowledge economy, when so many of our tasks require just as much attention and energy as they do time. Apart from my Soylent experiment, the only other productivity experiment I at least partially failed was my experiment to lower my body fat from 17 to 10%. In practice, the experiment was actually pretty similar to the Soylent experiment because it involved cutting foods out of my diet that I really wanted to eat in order to reach 10% body fat. I designed the experiment in two parts, lowering my body fat from 17% to 10% and gaining 10 pounds of lean muscle. By the end of my project, I gained almost 15 pounds of muscle, which I'll talk about two chapters from now. But instead of reaching 10% body fat, by the end of my project, my body fat still hovered around 15%. In hindsight, I realized that although getting to 10% body fat was a noble goal, I executed it terribly. As soon as my initial motivation for the experiments wore off, I hated the fact that I had to continue to go on. Because I tried to make drastic changes so I could achieve my goals more quickly, it wasn't realistic. Past Chris wasn't realistic when he designed the experiments for future Chris to follow, and didn't account for how difficult he would find the changes in practice. Much like with my Soylent experiment, I simply loved food too much. Chipping away. This is a pretty good illustration of just how hard productivity can be to achieve in practice. As I mentioned in the last chapter, to accomplish more, you often have to make sacrifices that are tough in the short term, but rewarding in the long term. And let's be honest, although it would be great if you could make every sacrifice I've talked about so far, not every sacrifice will be worth it to you. The key is to recognize which changes are worth your time and effort, and which ones aren't. To me, a great meal is one of the most pleasurable things out there. At the end of the day, I value productivity a tad more than the pleasure food gives me, but they're close. It may be worth the sacrifice, But I know that if I try to make changes that are too big in the short term, they simply won't stick, especially when my habits around food are so firmly ensconced. I know I'm not the only one who gets great pleasure out of food. Research shows that your brain releases about as much dopamine when you eat two cheeseburgers as when you have an orgasm. As I write these words, about a year after the end of my project, I'm now hovering at around 13% body fat, and I'm in the best shape of my life. But getting down to 13% body fat didn't happen overnight. It has involved making tiny incremental improvements to the way I eat, changes that have been small enough to not pose much of a burden when I make them, but large enough so that they add up to make a meaningful difference over time. There's absolutely nothing wrong with having huge ambitions. I think you should. But the more radical the changes you try to make to achieve them, the less likely they are to stick. For example, 1 week toward the end of my project, I started drinking my coffee black instead of with two creams and two sugars. We call this a double-double when you order it at Tim Hortons in Canada. A week or two after that, I began to put spinach and other vegetables in my breakfast omelet instead of sausage. By themselves, these changes are incremental enough that they're hardly worth talking about. But over time, they have compounded, and I gradually made enough of them to lower my body fat to that 13% level. And that percentage is steadily dropping as I continue to make incremental improvements. Small changes in habits add up over time. When you try to completely overhaul the way you eat overnight, your initial excitement and motivation will wear off, and the changes you tried to make will eventually become too large and intimidating for you to continue with them for the long term. The opposite is true for small, incremental changes. Since small changes aren't scary and don't impose too great a burden, in the long run, they'll actually stick. And as they add up, you'll become motivated to make more of them. One of my favorite ideas is that of compound interest. If you put $100 in an investment account today and received 8% interest on that money every year, by the 9th year, you'd be playing with the house's money. Your money will have more than doubled to $205. And if you didn't touch the account for 25 years, by the end of that time, your original $100 will have grown 7 times to $734, and it will only go up from there. The exact same thing is true with the incremental changes you make with your habits. The best way to lose weight fast is to hop on a fad diet. But once your initial motivation wears off, which it almost always does, chances are you'll revert to the habits you had before and gain all that weight back. Not many people write books on the power of making tiny incremental changes to the way you live and work, probably because the idea isn't all that sexy. But it works better than anything else I have tried. Like with interest at the bank, as you begin to make incremental improvements with every hotspot that makes up the portfolio of your life, your habits will compound and pay incredible dividends with time. Compound interest is also what makes reading books and investing in your learning so powerful. And best of all, the changes will actually stick. Eating for energy. The odd part about writing a chapter like this one is that you really don't need this book or any diet book to tell you how to eat better. While it's nice to be guided in the right direction every once in a while, chances are you know at least one improvement you can make to your diet to get more energy. Over the year of doing my project, as I charted my energy levels around what I ate, I found that eating for energy and productivity is actually very simple. While this chapter explores food from an energy and productivity standpoint rather than a health standpoint, in this case, the two are one and the same. The more I have lived by these two rules, the more energy I have had. The rules can be difficult in practice, particularly if you love food as much as I do, but the more you chip away at your habits and live by these two rules, the more energy you'll have. Here are the two rules. One. Eat more unprocessed foods that take longer to digest. And two, notice when you're full and then stop eating. These two rules are way easier to talk about than to practice, of course. But from my experience, they will provide you with more lasting energy than anything else. They're worth chipping away at over time. Food provides you with energy because your body converts whatever you eat into glucose, a simple sugar your body and brain burn for energy. Just as an oil refinery turns crude oil into gasoline for your car, your digestive system turns what you eat and drink into glucose for your body. On a neurological level, you have mental energy when you have glucose in your brain. When you feel tired or fatigued, more often than not, it's either because your brain has too much or not enough glucose to convert into mental energy. Research has shown that the optimal amount of glucose to have in your bloodstream is around 25 grams, about the amount of glucose in a banana. This exact number isn't all that important, but what is important is that your glucose levels can be either too high or too low. Since unprocessed foods, in general, take longer to digest, your body converts them into glucose at a slower rate, which provides you with a steady drip of glucose and energy over the course of the day instead of a big hit of it, followed by an energy crash. In a way, processed foods are pre-digested for you by machines. This is why your body converts them into glucose so fast and why a donut doesn't provide you with nearly as much lasting energy as an apple. There is also something called the glycemic index, GI, which tracks how foods affect your glucose levels on a scale from 0 to 100. The lower a food is on the scale, the better it is for your productivity because your body burns the food at a slower rate and doesn't release all its energy at once. While the index is informative, and if you want to take your energy levels up a notch or two, you should take a look at it, I found the list is a bit tedious to reference in practice. I know some health nuts will take issue with this, but I'm a fan of rules and systems that are easy to follow in practice. Sure, there are a few unprocessed foods that have a high GI, like baked potatoes and white rice, but most of the foods low on the index are unprocessed, like vegetables, fruits, nuts, seeds, beans and legumes, grains, seafood, and meat. Although not every single unprocessed food is great for you, most of them are. I've had a lot of energy eating fewer processed foods than with anything else. The second rule, notice when you're full and then stop eating, has a similar effect. It provides you with more energy because you're not overloading your body with food to process, and you provide your brain and body with a steady drip of glucose over the course of the day, so you don't spike your glucose levels all at once. This is why you feel tired or groggy when you overeat, because you ingested too much food for your body to process. You'll have lasting energy when you provide your body with a steady stream of glucose, not a massive hit of it all at once. During my meditation experiment, not only did I practice sitting and walking meditation, I also ate a few meals mindfully. One morning, while slowly and mindfully eating an omelet, I noticed something curious. When I devoted more of my attention to what I was eating, it became a lot easier for me to notice when I was feeling full, and I could stop eating before I ate too much. I also enjoyed what I was eating that much more. When I ate twice as slow, I enjoyed what I was eating for twice as long and got twice the enjoyment out of it, especially when I didn't focus on other things at the same time. The more I practiced mindful eating during and after this experiment, the more enjoyment I got out of food, and the more I learned to respect how full I was and was able to stop myself from eating too much. Studies show that it takes your stomach at least 15 minutes to tell your brain that it's full. The more attention you pay to eating, the better your odds of stopping before you're full and having more energy throughout the day. These two rules gave me more mental and physical energy than I'd had in a long time. And the smaller the changes I've made to what and how I ate, the more they've stuck and compounded. As far as your productivity is concerned, it's worth keeping these two rules in mind. The lamest diet in the world challenge. Time required, 2 minutes. Energy and focus required, 2 out of 10. Value, 8 out of 10. Fun, 7 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. Your energy levels will be more constant because you will provide your body and brain with a steady amount of glucose, which it burns off as energy throughout the day. The best diet in the world is the exact one you already have, with one small incremental improvement. Although this diet won't help you drop inches from your waist overnight, you'll actually stick with it in the long term. That's what matters, and you'll lose weight over time. My challenge for you is to make one small incremental improvement around how you eat. A change that'll cause you to either eat more unprocessed foods or become more mindful of how much you're eating and notice when you're full. Whether that improvement is not taking any sugar in your morning coffee, snacking on a plate of vegetables instead of chips during the game, no longer eating in front of your computer so you can notice when you're full, or eating dinner with your family instead of in front of the TV so you can devote more attention to eating, simply make one small, lasting change to the way you eat that won't be impossible for you to keep once your initial motivation to eat for more energy dies off. When you review your list of hotspots a week or a month from now, you can use that as a reminder to make another incremental improvement to your diet so you can level up even further. If you're like me, by that point, you'll be dying to make bigger or more changes to the way you eat. And that's the point. Small changes last because they don't suck up all your willpower, which gives you the energy you need to make further incremental improvements when the time comes. The power of incremental improvements lies in the fact that while they're not significant by themselves, week after week, month after month, they add up to produce long-term results that will blow you away. Chapter 23. Drinking for Energy. Takeaway. Luckily, what is good for your brain is good for your body. To drink for energy, drink fewer alcoholic and sugary drinks, drink more water, which is incredible for your brain health, and learn to drink caffeine strategically when you'll actually benefit from the energy boost, not habitually. Only water. As another productivity experiment, I drank only water for an entire month, cutting out all caffeine, alcohol, and sugary drinks from my diet. It's incredible just how many ingrained habits you have around what you drink over the course of the month, and I wanted to get to the bottom of how all the stuff I drank impacted my productivity, if at all. Not only did this save me a ton of money, I spend way more on coffee and alcohol every month than I think, I also learned a lot about just how profoundly what I drank affected my productivity. While eating no processed foods and stopping when you're full are great ways to increase your energy, drinking for energy is more difficult to figure out, especially when common beverages like caffeine and alcohol hardly make a dent in your glucose levels. A side note on sugary drinks. Every day, the average person consumes a whopping 356 calories through what he or she drinks, and 44% of those calories come from sugary drinks that give the consumer a huge glucose rush and then crash afterward. I didn't have the chance to play around with sugary drinks during this experiment. Though I drink the occasional smoothie, I've never had a habit of drinking sugary drinks. I've always tried to get as many of my calories from actual food as possible. There are also zero productivity benefits to drinking sugary drinks, so I've always steered clear of them. Even fruit juices that seem amazingly healthy for you on the surface spike glucose levels to crazy high levels and then cause an energy crash afterward. I mostly experimented with cutting out caffeine and alcohol from my diet during the experiment. Borrowing energy from tomorrow. Before starting the experiment, I didn't consume an excess of coffee or alcohol. Most days I had a cup or two of green tea, which contains about 20% of the caffeine in a cup of coffee, and every week I had a cup or two of coffee. I also only drank a few alcoholic drinks a week, usually socially or while watching a hockey game. Before the water experiment, I wasn't deliberate about when and what I drank, but that quickly began to change as I had the chance to step back to reflect on how both alcohol and caffeine either helped or hindered my productivity. Something is considered a drug when it has a physiological effect on your body, and caffeine and alcohol are no exception to this rule. As an example, both boost how much dopamine, a main pleasure chemical in your brain, the neural pathways in your brain produce, essentially rewarding you for consuming caffeine and alcohol. Dopamine isn't entirely a bad thing, and it would be hard to become motivated without it, but it does make certain substances more rewarding than others. While I didn't experience any withdrawal while cutting out caffeine or alcohol, I did notice something intriguing. By the end of the month, I began to have an insane amount of energy, particularly on weekends. Not only that, but the amount of energy I had, again, especially over the weekend, was incredibly stable and didn't fluctuate nearly as much as when I consumed a few or more drinks every week. After I noticed these effects and conducted some research to dive deeper into them, I began to realize, much like sugar, alcohol isn't worth consuming for productivity reasons. Drinking alcohol also doesn't even make a dent on reducing the stress hormones in your body. Alcohol may provide you with a bit more energy or creativity as you drink it, but it will also almost always provide you with a net loss in energy and productivity and make it much more difficult to accomplish what you intend to, especially after you come down off the buzz the drug gives you. I see drinking alcohol as a way of borrowing energy from tomorrow, but in the morning, you have to pay interest on that energy loan. This leaves you with a net loss in energy, and mixing alcohol with either sugar or caffeine only exacerbates that crash. Of course, this is a cost a lot of people are willing to pay, and this gets to my point at the beginning of the book about making changes that are meaningful to you. Every once in a while, I'm willing to put up with these costs. When I'm out with friends, I sometimes have a few drinks, but only after I consider the energy costs that they will have and mentally assess whether those costs are worth it. If you intend to have a wild and crazy night, then do, all the more power to you. But do consider the costs. Since my water experiment, I've begun to account for the fact that I will have a net loss in energy whenever I have a drink or two. And I will usually drink more water that night and the next day to dampen their effects. Since discovering just how much energy I had when I didn't drink, I've cut my alcohol consumption in half. This isn't saying a lot when I didn't drink heavily to begin with, but I would encourage you to think about the fact that alcohol can have a significant impact on your energy levels and productivity when you decide whether or not to have a drink or two or three. A lot of the productivity and diet books I've read suggest cutting alcohol completely out of your diet, but I think for most people that's either too draconian to stick with in the long term or something they just don't want to do. At least by understanding the costs of drinking on your energy levels and productivity, you are aware of the impact on your decisions. Then you can decide if you wish to change your habits accordingly. By the way, if you're a fan of having a nightcap before you head to bed to help you sleep, watch out. While alcohol has been shown to help you fall asleep faster, it compromises your overall sleep quality, particularly toward the end of your sleep session. Adapting to coffee. Just as drinking alcohol is a way of borrowing energy from tomorrow, drinking caffeine is a way of borrowing energy from later in the day. If there were a way of consuming caffeine without crashing afterwards, it would be an absolute no-brainer as far as productivity is concerned. This unfortunately isn't the case. 8 to 14 hours after you consume caffeine, your body metabolizes it out of your system, which causes an energy crash, though this exact number varies from person to person. There is a chemical in your body and brain called adenosine, which tells your brain when it's tired. Caffeine prevents your brain from absorbing this chemical, which prevents your brain from knowing it's tired. But here's the thing. While caffeine blocks your brain from absorbing adenosine, the chemical continues to build up until caffeine eventually lets your brain absorb it again. Your body and brain then absorb a whole whack of this tired chemical at once, which causes your energy levels to plummet. There are a few ways to lessen these effects, which we'll get to, but there isn't a way to prevent them. At the same time, though, while you invariably crash after consuming anything with caffeine in it, caffeine can be a powerful tool to have at your disposal as far as your productivity is concerned, when you begin to drink it deliberately instead of habitually. Sense a theme? Let's say you have a ritual of preparing yourself a fresh, steaming cup of coffee every morning. Although this ritual is a romantic one and a graceful way to ease into the day, it isn't all that great for your energy levels. Since drinking coffee is a way of borrowing energy from later in the day. Having a daily cup of coffee in the morning simply causes your energy levels to dip at the same time every afternoon. Since it takes your body 8 to 14 hours to metabolize caffeine, if you have a cup after you wake up, this means you'll crash at the same time every day in the late afternoon, when you'll have to choose to either slog through a wave of low energy or drink another cup, which may compromise your sleep, since your body will only begin to metabolize the caffeine a couple of hours before you head to bed. This is a downward spiral more than a few people fall into. But there is another downside to drinking coffee habitually that's easy to overlook. Your body adapts to how much caffeine you consume. In other words, if you have one cup of coffee every morning, your body slowly gets used to that amount until it becomes your new normal. In fact, your brain even begins to grow new adenosine receptors as it acclimates to how much caffeine you consume. At first, when you go from drinking no coffee to drinking one cup of coffee, you get a huge burst of energy and productivity. And this feedback is immediate, which reinforces your new coffee habit. But once your body gets used to that amount of coffee, to reach a comparable caffeine high, you need to drink two cups of coffee every morning because your body has adapted to drinking one. If you simply continue drinking only one cup every morning, the science shows that you're no better off than when you started. During my experiment to drink only water for a month, I didn't experience any caffeine withdrawal. But I quickly began to miss the stuff at the times I used to drink it. When I ran across cues in my work environment that triggered my habit of having a cup of tea or coffee, things like attending an important meeting, working on a high return task, or visiting the gym. That's when I realized just how powerful becoming deliberate about when you consume caffeine can be. When you consume caffeine habitually, your productivity eventually flatlines after your body adapts to how much caffeine you consume. But when you drink caffeine strategically, your productivity takes off because you'll begin to benefit from bringing more energy and attention to tasks that require a large amount of energy, focus, or both. The most productive way to drink caffeine. As I write these words, it's 10:30 a.m. and I'm sitting in a small coffee shop close to home, sipping on a medium black coffee. While I don't have a habit of drinking a lot of coffee, on days like today, I like to. Doing so is letting me bring even more energy and focus to writing this book, and in my view, is worth the cost later on. There are periods of the day when having extra energy will help you out the most, and for me, this is one of them. Making the jump from drinking caffeine habitually to strategically is a tough one to make, but it's worth chipping away at. If you're hooked on coffee and drink two cups every day, for example, you can begin by filling each cup up with a quarter of decaf coffee. You'll likely not notice much of a difference. The great thing is, something magical happens as you begin to drink caffeine strategically instead of habitually. You suddenly have access to a large reservoir of energy that you can summon whenever you need it the most. The more demanding a task is, the more having that extra energy will benefit you when it comes time to work on it. During my project, and particularly after my water experiment, I began to consume caffeine before doing tasks like giving an important presentation, writing a big article, working on one of my three daily intentions, diving into a complicated research paper, or a big workout. Caffeine has been shown to positively affect athletic performance. A quick note for if you're an introvert. Caffeine has been shown to make introverts perform poorer on tasks that are quantitative and done under time pressure, whereas it has been found to have the opposite effect for extroverts. This is because introverts are more stimulated by their environment by default, and that extra caffeine can push them over the edge. As an ambivert, I fall somewhere in between, maybe even a little on the introverted side, and have found that a moderate amount of caffeine positively impacts my performance in nearly all situations. In addition to drinking caffeine at more strategic times, here are a few suggestions for drinking caffeine strategically in general. Don't drink any sugary or alcoholic caffeinated drinks. They'll only cause you to crash quicker and harder. Be careful about drinking caffeine before working on a creative task, because caffeine has been shown to hurt your performance with tasks that involve creativity. Be mindful that you don't consume caffeine less than 8 to 14 hours before bed so it doesn't affect your sleep. If it makes sense for your productivity, consume caffeine between 9:30 and 11:30 a.m. if you wake up between 6 and 8. This is when caffeine will have the greatest impact on your energy levels because you naturally have less energy then when your cortisol levels are lower. Caffeine also has a bigger effect between 1:30 and 5:30 p.m., but because it needs 8 to 14 hours to leave your system, it's likely not worth the impact it will have on your sleep. Find a better caffeine delivery system, like green tea or matcha. Green tea and matcha are my favorite caffeine vehicles because they're chock full of antioxidants and L-theanine, which ease the caffeine crash afterwards. Matcha is a tad more expensive than tea and coffee, but I think it's well worth the price. For a few extra bucks, you essentially buy back some energy that you'll be able to use later in the day. When you consider how your energy levels can have such a huge impact on how much you accomplish, it's often worth the extra cost. Use an energy crash strategically. I often like to drink a big cup of coffee 12 hours before an overnight flight, so I crash just in time to sleep all the way through the flight. And when I travel overseas, I like to drink coffee a few hours after I wake up, so I have a ton of energy throughout the day and crash in time for my new bedtime. The productivity possibilities are endless when you step back to consume caffeine strategically. This is yet another reason why becoming more deliberate is so powerful. For the love of water. While my original intention with the water experiment was to observe how removing caffeine and alcohol from my diet would affect my productivity, I should have guessed how much more energy I would have when I consumed only water all month. Water is like meditation, so simple but so pure and so powerful. As far as drinks go, it's by far the most basic, but after this experiment, it's become my clear favorite, and I've had a bottle of water by my side ever since. Every morning, the very first thing I do after waking up is to drink a liter of water. And on most days, I don't stop drinking water until I go to bed. An innumerable number of studies back up just how great water is for your health and productivity. One study found that drinking water first thing in the morning fires up your metabolism, making it 24% faster. Plus, you're usually dehydrated when you wake up because you just went 8 hours without drinking anything. Another discovered that participants who drank a glass of water before every meal lost 4.5 pounds over 3 months. Why? Because water partly fills your stomach before you eat and acts as a calorie-free appetite suppressant. Water also helps you think more clearly. Your brain tissue is made up of 75% water, clears up your complexion, and significantly reduces your risk of many diseases and ailments. Drinking more water will even save you money. I'm a huge fan of living frugally. I see saving money as a way of buying back my own time in the future, and so every glass of water I drink is one glass of something costly that I don't drink. Drinking water for a month saved me $150 because I didn't allow myself to buy other, more expensive, less healthy drinks. Yes, water is boring as far as drinks go, unless you're a total badass and mix things up by drinking carbonated or flavored water, but don't overlook it. Unlike alcohol or sugary drinks that rob you of energy later on, or caffeine, which can wreak havoc on your energy levels when you don't drink it deliberately, water invariably leaves you with more energy than you started with. And when you drink 3 liters a day, if you're a woman, or 4 liters a day, if you're a man, I think you'll be surprised at how much more energy you have, particularly if you aren't hydrated enough already. I've found that I need more than the recommended 8 cups, 2 liters a day, to perform at an optimal level. Many organizations, including the U.S. Institute of Medicine, have found the same. Not getting enough water can cause fatigue, sleepiness, and anxiety, and make it more difficult to concentrate, all of which hurt your productivity. After my water experiment finished up, I went out and bought a 1-liter water bottle that I carry with me everywhere. I fill it 4 times a day. Drinking more water and fewer energy hijacking drinks is a simple tactic, but getting enough H2O will help you keep kicking ass all day long. Just as many people could eat half of what they already do and not be hungry, a lot of people could double their water intake and feel that much better. The Water Challenge. Time required, 2 minutes. Energy and focus required, 2 out of 10. Value, 7 out of 10. Fun, 7 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. You'll experience far fewer energy crashes throughout the day and have much more overall energy throughout the week. Energy is the fuel that you burn in order to be productive. Drinking more water and fewer alcoholic, sugary, and even caffeinated beverages will give you more to burn over the course of the day and week. My challenge for you is to, this week, make one small incremental improvement to what you drink. It's almost impossible to completely overhaul what you drink overnight if you want the changes to stick. Here are a few ideas of habits you can work on. Consume fewer sugary drinks. Sugary drinks spike your glucose levels and cause a huge energy crash later on. For productivity reasons alone, they aren't worth drinking. And sugary drinks that contain caffeine or alcohol can wreak havoc on your energy levels. Reduce your caffeine tolerance. Over time, this will help you drink caffeine strategically. Reducing how much caffeine you drink is especially helpful when you drink multiple cups every day, which can cause adrenal exhaustion over time and stress you out. Drink caffeine strategically, like before hunkering down on a pressing task or when you need the energy the most, such as between 9:30 and 11:30 a.m. for most people. Drink less alcohol. Yes, alcohol is fun, and that enjoyment is often worth the cost. But when you chip away at how much alcohol you drink over time, you'll be surprised by just how much more energy you'll have. Luckily, what is good for your brain is good for your body. Becoming more productive is a process of learning to work and live more deliberately. And when what you eat and drink has such a profound effect on your energy levels, I think both are worth taking a second look at, especially if your energy levels fluctuate quite a bit over the course of the day. Chapter 24, The Exercise Pill. Takeaway. The amount of energy and focus that exercise provides you with in return for your time is incredible, and easily worth the challenge of integrating an exercise routine into your life. After you feel how much of an impact exercise has on your brain, I think you'll want to continue with the routine, if only to make the feeling last. DIY brain surgery. As far as productivity is concerned, habits are insanely powerful. At their most elemental level, habits are made up of neurological pathways that automatically fire in response to different cues in your environment. Although habits are not always easy to form, when you establish the right habits for the right reasons, they're worth the effort in the end. Every habit takes willpower and perseverance to create. If it didn't, we could simply decide to make huge changes to how we work to become more productive than we ever have been. Because you have a limited amount of willpower to draw from every day, you have to use your willpower sparingly and intelligently. That's why these tactics are so important. It takes effort, but the right habits are worth the willpower you'll spend on them. Every tactic in this book, from the rule of three to meditation, can become a habit when you practice it enough. This is especially true when you understand the three elements that make up the habit loop. Define a few cues that trigger you to do the tactics, a time, place, emotion, people, or preceding behavior. Start small and overcome your resistance to the change by battling procrastination and shrinking the change on a daily basis. Studies show that the amount of willpower you have is steadily depleted as you expend it over the day. Being smart about making new habits by following these techniques will let you make habits that actually stick. Because forming new habits is a way of carving out new neurological pathways in your brain, when you take the effort to form new habits, in a way, you perform brain surgery on yourself on a microscopic level. This isn't easy, and it takes effort to carve out those pathways, but as soon as you do, you won't need to expend any more willpower on them. You'll become more productive automatically. Exercising for productivity. Much of the reason why it's so difficult to be productive today has to do with the fact that the working world has evolved much faster than our brain. We procrastinate because our prefrontal cortex hasn't evolved to become stronger than our limbic system, which is seduced by the unproductive tasks in our work. We find the internet and multitasking so stimulating because they're candy for our limbic system, but they harm our productivity. We feel tempted to overeat and eat highly processed foods because we evolved to stockpile fat to live off of during those times we had to go without food for long stretches of time. All these traits have allowed us to evolve and survive. But since the Industrial Revolution, the structure of our working world has changed faster than the structure of our brain, which has made it difficult to adapt at times. Forming new habit pathways in our brain is hard enough, let alone reshaping our brain to become more productive in the knowledge economy. Exercise is no exception to this. It's because of our evolutionary history that the productivity benefits of getting more exercise, especially aerobic exercise, can be so profound. It's an unfortunate fact that most jobs in the knowledge economy don't involve a lot of physical activity. Today, the amount of physical activity we get has never been lower. One recent study by the Physical Activity Council found that 28% of the U.S. population did not get any physical activity in the entire 2014 calendar year. This is terrible, not just from a health standpoint, but also from a productivity standpoint. While our brains have evolved a bit since the Stone Age, 2.5 million years ago, our bodies haven't. Our bodies are built to walk 5 to 9 miles every day to hunt and gather food, not to spend 52 hours staring at screens every week. This affects our work performance because of how our brain deals with stress. Today, we are not only less active than we have ever been, we also have more distractions, demands, and deadlines in a typical day than we've ever had. Not to mention that we evolved to deal with stress that was short-lived, not lasting for days on end. You've probably heard of the whole fight-or-flight concept before. This refers to how your body and brain respond to stressful situations. If you were to come face-to-face with a saber-toothed tiger, for example, you would instinctually decide whether to fight the tiger or flee from it. When you start to exercise, and this is especially the case with aerobic exercise, your brain sees it as a fight-or-flight situation, which causes your brain to release a concoction of chemicals that prepare you to fight the treadmill. These chemicals have a ton of neurological benefits, especially as far as stress relief is concerned. Biochemically speaking, exercise allows your brain to fight stress in a productive and controlled way. But exercise doesn't only help you release stress. It also has a plethora of other benefits that will let you accomplish more. Exercise increases how much blood flows to your brain, which increases your mental performance and creativity. It combats fatigue in addition to stress and helps you bring more focus to your work. And studies show that in addition to bulking up your muscles, exercise quite literally bulks up your brain. When you exercise, your brain releases BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, a chemical that helps you create new brain cells. A lot of this growth happens in the hippocampus, the part of your brain responsible for memory. Exercise has even been shown to boost your mood and build cells in brain regions damaged by depression. 15 pounds. Pretty much everyone has come across a stat or two about how great exercise is for your body and brain and how it releases endorphins and other wonderful things. When I started my project, I had heard about many of the stats I just named and had felt a few of the benefits firsthand, but these studies didn't move me much, even though I knew they were scientifically true. My rational, geeky prefrontal cortex ate the stats up but they didn't motivate my limbic system to actually care enough about exercising in the long run to do it. This disconnect is what motivated me to experiment with how exercise impacted my productivity. To experiment with exercise and productivity, as I mentioned earlier, I designed a productivity experiment to gain 10 pounds of lean muscle while lowering my body fat from 17 to 10%. Looking back, there was nothing wrong with the goal of the experiment, but the changes I tried to make to get there were way too ambitious to stick with for the long haul. The experiments were also far too difficult, ambiguous, and unstructured, which didn't help. Indeed, I didn't stick with it, and only lowered my body fat to about 15% by the end of my project. But while I struggled to make drastic changes to how I ate, I was able to stick to my daily exercise ritual almost immediately. To make the experiment more realistic, I forced myself to work out outside of regular working hours instead of in the middle of the day, when a lot of people don't have the flexibility to do so. I folded the ritual into my habit of waking up ultra early every morning. I'll talk about this a bit in the next chapter, but I really believe that if it weren't for my exercise ritual, I would have ended my experiment to wake up at 5:30 every morning much sooner. As a pretty geeky guy, I've usually spent more time at the library than at the gym, though I have worked out off and on for as long as I can remember. When I ramped up this experiment, not having experienced the rush that came along with intense exercise that often, I almost instantly felt incredible. Every morning for several months, I settled into a routine of waking up at 5:30, walking over to my office, drinking a caffeine-based pre-workout drink, and then walking over to the gym, which was about a 10-minute walk from where I lived. Once there, still disconnected because of my daily shut-off ritual, I would listen to a podcast, audiobook, or Taylor Swift's new album while doing 30 minutes of cardio and then lift weights for about 45 minutes. I started with going for just a half an hour in the morning, but quickly ramped up the ritual once I felt less and less resistance to it and found a few friends to work out with every morning. Starting small was what got me going, but the benefits of exercise gave me the motivation to continue. Looking back at my exercise habit, which I still follow only later on in the day, it turns out that I had designed the perfect ritual for me, even though I didn't realize it at the time. I started small at a level I was comfortable with, 30 minutes in the morning, and ratcheted that up over time as I felt less and less resistance to the habit. And I had almost every habit cue under the sun. A time, 6 a.m., place, the same gym every morning, emotion, feeling energized after having my pre-workout drink or coffee, the presence of people I knew, my workout buddies, and a preceding behavior, waking up early. I didn't feel a lot of resistance to the habit and made the habit more fun by listening to audiobooks and podcasts, which helped a ton. Contrary to what a lot of people say, there isn't a set number of days that it takes to integrate a new habit into your life. If you want to form a new habit of eating a chocolate bar every morning, for example, I bet it would take you just a day or two, and the opposite would be the case if you tried to form a new habit of walking on glass. For me, going to the gym felt exhilarating, especially considering almost every other element of my project involved almost zero physical activity and involved a lot of mental lifting. I believe that getting consistent exercise regularly is one of the reasons I was so productive during my project. I wrote 216,897 words by the time it was over. Best of all, as soon as I settled into a regular workout routine, I worked out 3 to 5 days every week. My stress melted away, which resulted in a much more productive version of myself. I no longer experienced mental fatigue, and ironically enough, the more energy I seemed to expend at the gym, the more energy I had while working the rest of the day. Throughout the winter months, I was a lot happier and more upbeat. My mood usually dips along with the cold Canadian winter. And the challenges in my work didn't faze me one bit. I had more resiliency to face any crises that arose. Like with meditation, exercise changed how I related to what I experienced. Every morning, I left my stress at the gym and was able to gain more energy throughout the day and become more productive. As the months went by, my incremental changes added up, and I slowly gained more and more muscle mass until, as I mentioned earlier, at the end of my project, I had gained 15 pounds of muscle. 50% more than I had intended to. Picture 15 pounds of lean meat at the grocery store, only as muscle on a person. The time cost. There is, of course, one problem with exercising for productivity reasons. The time you spend exercising has to come from somewhere, and for most people, that time comes from commitments that may feel more important. I've written about diet, exercise, and in the next chapter, sleep, because I think they're worth your time. But this is the challenge with the tactics in this part, and a couple of the other tactics in this audiobook, like meditation. When the average person looks at the choice between doing an extra 30 minutes of work and getting in 30 minutes of aerobic exercise, or more sleep, better meals, meditation, and so on, the better choice, at least as far as productivity is concerned, appears to be to work for 30 minutes longer. Doing extra work is easier and more stimulating than exercise, and you feel less guilty doing it. But in practice, while in the short run you may get some extra work done in those 30 minutes, in the long run, you accomplish more by nurturing your energy levels, not, as our friend Tim Pitchell would say, by giving in to feel good. Nurturing your energy levels will ultimately save you time, because you'll be able to bring more energy and focus to your work and get the same amount accomplished in less time. Like with every other tactic in this audiobook, exercise lets you spend your time more efficiently. The same thing holds true for the time you spend eating better and getting enough sleep. All three activities provide you with a net gain in time and productivity, despite how hard they may be to do in the moment. That's not to say they'll be worth it 100% of the time. There will be some days when you will, and should, value working an extra hour over eating well or hitting the gym, and others where you might value going out to have fun over getting a full night's sleep. But overall, as you make course corrections and incremental improvements with each passing week to become more productive, I think you'll find they're worth your time. Since my exercise experiment, and even since the end of my project, a few times I've been seduced by the idea of working longer hours instead of hitting the gym. I've fallen off the wagon. But every single time I've fallen, I got right back on. Not because I felt guilty about not living up to what I wrote about on my blog, but because I accomplished less and had less energy in the tank to do good work when I did. In his book, Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, John Rady writes that exercise, quote, is the single most powerful tool you have to optimize your brain function, end quote. He even goes so far as to say, quote, if exercise came in pill form, it would be plastered across the front page, hailed as the blockbuster drug of the century, end quote. I wholeheartedly agree. Exercise is worth your time and is one of the best things you can do to become more productive. The more active you are, the more energy you'll have to burn. The heart rate challenge. Time required, 15 minutes. Energy and focus required, 7 out of 10. Value, 7 out of 10. Fun, 9 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. You experience the incredible neurological benefits of exercise, including having more energy, focus, stamina, resilience, and memory, and less stress and fatigue. Exercise is worth your time. My challenge for you this chapter is to elevate your heart rate for 15 minutes tomorrow, either by walking, jogging, hopping on an elliptical machine, or doing any other form of aerobic exercise that gets your blood pumping faster than it normally does. If you feel a lot of mental resistance to working out for 15 minutes, shrink how long you'll work out until you no longer feel resistance to the challenge. This challenge is designed especially for people who get a limited amount of physical activity right now, or who have fallen off the wagon in terms of exercise. If you already have a regular workout habit, I challenge you to up your game even further and make one small incremental improvement to your workout regimen. The key to making lasting changes to your behavior is to make changes to your habits that are small enough to not intimidate you when your initial motivation wears out. This is especially important with exercise. Exercising can be a beast of a challenge. especially as motivation and procrastination, which are opposite sides of the same coin, are concerned. For many people, exercise is boring, frustrating, difficult, ambiguous, and unstructured. No wonder people put it off. This is why starting small and then continuing incrementally is key. Making incremental improvements will help you sustain your motivation and momentum. After you do the challenge, ask yourself, how do I feel? Is your head clearer? Do you have more energy? Do you feel less stressed out, less fatigued? When you feel how much of an effect exercise has on your brain, I think you'll want to continue the routine and make an effort to turn exercise into a habit. The increased energy and focus exercise provides you in return for your time and willpower are well worth it. Chapter 25, Sleeping Your Way to Productivity. Takeaway. Although cutting back on sleep saves you time, any amount of sleep you lose below the amount your body requires is not worth the productivity cost. For every hour of sleep you miss out on, you lose at least 2 hours of productivity. The costs associated with not getting enough sleep are that great. The apocalypse is nigh. Believe it or not, there is a zombie apocalypse happening right now. If you look outside your window, you'll see people who are the walking dead. They can't concentrate, remember much, drive safely, or get through the day with enough energy or focus. They drone through the day mindlessly on autopilot. This phenomenon is becoming so rampant that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has labeled it an epidemic. These zombies even cause 80,000 automobile accidents every year. All right under our noses. You might even be one of them. But unlike the zombies from the movies,